Hello, my name is Renee. I'm a cosplayer from Snohomish County, and this is Northwest Nerd. Broadcasting from the crossroads of fandom, bringing you news, entertainment, and the stories that make us nerds. With your host, pop culture journalist, Dyer Oxley.
And that is me, pop culture journalist Dyer Oxley. With me today for this episode of Northwest Nerd is cosplayer and artist Rainey Renton. Rainey, how's it going?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you for letting me join you.
I am so honored to have you on this episode. We had you on the Festivus episode, which went as well as a Festivus episode usually goes, so I'm hoping to prove to you that things do get better on Northwest Nerd. Not only do we have Rainey, we also have a discussion with Todd Jones. You may know him from his work at ReadPop, parent company of Emerald City Comic Con. He was global director of content and celebrity talent, and I say was because, like a lot of people in this industry that we love so much, he was laid off in late 2020. So he's now talking about, you know, the year that all these conventions have just endured, what went on behind the scenes, and also providing us some industry perspective on what could lay ahead. Also in this episode, I'm very excited about it. NASA's Perseverance rover has just landed on Mars, but back here on Earth, specifically in Seattle, the search for ancient life is just starting. Specifically for Dr. Tim Elum, he joins us to explain exactly what this connection between Seattle and Mars is. Finally, we'll have a little bit of a discussion on Netflix, which has been a lifeline for a lot of us during these times. Netflix just released some data. It's been very interesting, and it's been very transparent about some demographics of its content and its company. We're going to get into that, but first, I want to check in with you, Rainey.
Mm-hmm.
I think most folks are probably familiar with you because of your cosplay and your Twitch channel, correct?
I would hope so. I mean, like, I hope that's what I'm known for. But yes, I think so.
Well, I mean, when I look you up, Rainey Renton, what is she up to these days? I usually come across cosplay stuff, but what I also come across is you're actually an artist as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Yes, I do art and cosplay and streaming, and I make most of my own cosplays too. A lot of the quarantine has made me buy more cosplays, but I still like style my own wigs and stuff just because it's easier than having to go out to Joann's every couple of minutes or every couple of days buy new stuff. So
what do you feel that is more of your favorite cosplay? I don't know if favorite's the right word to ever really say, but I mean, what do you prefer to cosplay more than others?
I guess it's really difficult to decide that because like I feel like there's a cool thing to cosplay for anything, like type of outfit, but I feel that most of what I cosplay has tended to be like school uniforms or like whatever a character would wear throughout most of the show or game that they're in.
Yeah.
Which usually the things that I cosplay from are anime. I do cosplay from some games, but like they're in their school uniform most of the time and it's like usually easily recognizable. Also, what's great about if you cosplay a school uniform is if there's multiple characters you want to cosplay that all wear the same uniform, all you do is change your wig, change your makeup, and now you've done multiples of them.
Final little thing that I was going to pick your brain about. Before we turned on the mic here, we were talking about how, I don't know, you let me know if this is appropriate to say. You told me that breakfast today was chicken nuggets. Is that okay to reveal? Okay,
yes.
So chicken nuggets.
Of course it is. McDonald's chicken nuggets specifically.
Yeah, which I would argue is actually, that's all meals. I think chicken nuggets are appropriate for breakfast, lunch, dinner. I don't know what's in them. I don't think I want to know what's actually
in them.
We
don't ask what's in them.
We don't ask.
We just like the way they taste.
They do. they are the best chicken nugget. They are the superior chicken nugget. And you got Pokemon cards with them?
I did get Pokemon cards with them because they are having a collaboration right now for Pokemon's 25th anniversary. So you get, if you get a kid's meal, if they're not sold out, you get like a little pamphlet with some stickers that you can like put Pokemon on, a little coloring book, and then 4 Pokemon cards that are special to this set, I guess.
It's not unusual. Pokemon and McDonald's do stuff all the time. I just feel like it's weird to get Pokemon cards from McDonald's for some reason. My brain just doesn't line up that way. But you collect weird things. But for you, this isn't weird enough. So what exactly then qualifies as a weird thing for you to collect?
Well, like, these are cheap, too. That's one thing. So, like, I like to collect Magical Girl wands, and that's, like, might be a weird thing to say. So if you've ever seen Sailor Moon or Magical Do-Re-Mi, which could also be known as Ojimajo, lots of Magical Girl shows will have full-length wands, or even, like, Cardcaptor Sakura. There is a, like, subsidiary of Bandai that makes what they call proplicas, which are full one-to-one replicas of these items. And so I like to collect specifically Magical Girl wands. So I have, like, every one that Proplica has ever put out for Sailor Moon. I will sometimes spend quite a bit of money, though, to get things, because a couple of the ones that I have are from, like, 1999. So they're not really made anymore. So...
See, this is why I like having you on the show, at least why I have before. Egypt is another person who's been on the show with you. I liked having him on there. Anime is not really my nerd niche. It's something that I've somewhat kind of grown into. Last time, after talking with you in Egypt before about Full Metal Alchemist, I've actually turned it on. And I
did you like it?
I love it. I almost swore there. Oh, that's good. How much I love it. I don't have to bleep that out. But I love it. It is geniusly laid out as far as a world building perspective goes, and I was not expecting that whatsoever. So thank you very, very much for that. I haven't told Egypt that yet, but yeah, Full Metal Alchemist, wasn't expecting that one. Great recommendation. Okay.
Oh, good.
Let's get straight into our feature for this episode. Todd Jones went from Emerald City Comic Con to working at their parent company in Reed Pop as its global director of content and celebrity talent. And therefore, he has been behind the scenes as they plan the conventions that we love so much. And he was there over this past year. Reed Pop had to make some tough decisions. As we all know, it was a pandemic year. He is no longer with the company, I should say. He does go into explaining a little bit of that in the interview I just had with him. I thought it might be a good idea to pick his brain a little bit over these trials that pop culture conventions have been dealing with. And more importantly, what exactly can we expect from this industry moving forward? Okay, so I'm going to break a rule with you, all right? This is one of my biggest pet peeves that I have with podcasts, with interviews. It's the who are you question, you know? Hey, I brought you on to my podcast. Who are you? A few years ago when we first met, because I'm a good stalker or journalist, I came across an article with you, I think, from your hometown newspaper, and it kind of talked about your career path. And I've always kind of found that fascinating, but also curious. How did you end up in the Comic-Con industry?
Well, let me see if I can make a long story not quite as long.
Okay.
When I got to college, I went into pre-law with the thoughts of going into law enforcement or something like that. That did not work out. Long story, very short. I fell into real estate, which worked for me at the time. I came out of real estate and fell into the convention industry. Now, to back up a little bit, I've always been a pop culture junkie. I am a firm Gen Xer. I was raised on the television. I collected comic books starting when I was 14. I broke into comic books. My gateway was actually Crisis on Infinite Earths. When I moved to the Linwood area, we were at a strip mall, took a walk two stores over to the comic stop and met the owner, Jim DeMonacos. He and I got to be friends. I opened a box there. He was always talking about, you know, we've got to get a good convention going on. Because at the time, the only convention that was going on, and I can't remember the name of it now, but it was a convention that would always took place in, it was a hotel ballroom or it was the basement of Key Arena or something. And it was like, bring $5 or two cans of food. But Jim always wanted to do something bigger and better. And eventually that became Emerald City Comic Con. He and his brother and a few other people founded Emerald City Comic Con, which launched in 2003. I was not a part of Emerald City Comic Con then, although it was very interesting. I always thought conventions weren't for me. I was a collector. So I attended a couple of the early ones. I would walk the show floor. I'd buy a couple statues. I'd dig through the long boxes. But it kept growing. And a few years later, all of the customers at the store were volunteering for the con in one way or another. So when I fell out of real estate, at that point, the convention had grown considerably. On top of that, the comic store, the comic stop, had grown considerably as well. So I was laid off. This was the last recession. This was 09. I was laid off from the job I had. And I started hanging out a little bit more in the store, about to get out of the house and things like that. And I bartered a shift every now and then to pay for my comics. You know, they hired me, they hired a few other people, just as kind of staff, and that was great. But we all also worked at the con, and we all had our jobs with the con, so we were kind of pulling double duty. I started working with the celebrity faction of Emerald City Comic Con. The first year, they really had big celebrities. But the first lineup was, well, the final lineup was Julie Benz, it was Jamie Bamber, and it was Baby Boba Fett. That kind of became my focus within the convention, was the celebrity stuff. So moving ahead just a little bit, I'm now general manager of the chain. We have four stores at the Comic Stop, and I've become director of celebrity operations. Come 2014, things begin to escalate in terms of Repop. A few things shift around, and my job shifts out of the stores and over to the convention full-time. The acquisition happened. Repop bought Emerald City Comic Con. We went official with that January 1, 2015. And along with that, Repop hired me to handle all of the talent acquisition for all of their cons. So I went from doing one convention to doing 20 over across our global portfolio for a while. Fortunately, due to the pandemic and all the other conditions, I was actually laid off from Repop back in November. But that's a similar story across the industry, which is something else we can talk about. But really, it's not as Byzantine a path as it seems. My pre-law background certainly helped with the contract negotiations.
You bring up Jim. Jim was the very first interview I had on Northwest Nerd, and I have forever apologized for that interview. I interviewed him when I was making a very rough transition from, like I said, like a newspaper reporter to learning that, oh, people actually have to like hearing me now. And he was there for that transition. I've always wanted to have him back on and be like, it got better. But but he was so game and he was so on board and say, yeah, let's help you out. I'll tell the Emerald City Comic Con story and you can work with that. So you touched on this a little bit there. Let's dive right into it. I'm sorry to hear about the layoff late last year. Seems like that is emblematic of something that's going on larger in the industry. So let's talk about 2020. I'm kind of curious, what was the conversation going on behind the scenes in the Comic-Con industry as this shakeup occurred over last year?
There was a lot of hopeful optimism, to be honest with you. Like in the beginning, I'll say we in the universal sense. I can't necessarily speak for Repop, but I can speak, you know, for how I was feeling. Like we were all cautiously and hopefully optimistic that this was going to be a short term issue.
Yeah.
That, you know, it was at the time, like we all hoped that it was just some, you know, aggressive flu and that, you know, things get taken care of. We pushed dates. We didn't cancel shows. And everybody was doing the same thing. Everybody was just kind of, you know, everybody pushed things into the latter half of the year. We managed to get Repop, Read Exhibitions, managed to get, I think, three shows off before the whole thing shut down in 2020. And the last show I did was C2E2. We were really just hoping that this going to kind of be the thing. And even then, we were taking precautions, right? Nobody was doing handshakes. Everybody was doing fist bumps. We had hand sanitizer everywhere. We were, you know, using gloves. We weren't quite at the mask stage yet, but we were getting there. And as we got out of that con, we got back to the office. We were prepping for Emerald City, which was supposed to be 2 weeks after that. We didn't know. We were all kind of huddled in conference rooms and we were watching news reports and everything coming out of not only Washington, D.C., but out of Seattle, out of things. You know, everything was streaming online, so we were able to watch, you know, local Seattle news, you know, back there.
And probably a lot of fans pounding on their keyboards. What's going to happen? What's going to happen?
There was a lot of that. I mean, it's the internet, right? So there's always a lot of just wild speculation. But Washington at the time, obviously, you know, as you know, was one of the hot spots. So the moving of Emerald City was kind of a foregone conclusion. But as these things go, we can't announce that until we're confirmed, you know, with new dates. You don't want to postpone something and not have some place to put it.
Right.
So while ReadPop, you know, worked with the Washington State Convention Center to get the new dates and all these things, we were also looking ahead at the rest of our conventions. We had, you know, we had the newly acquired Florida SuperCon coming up. We had Keystone after that. We had New York Comic Con, you know, in October. And what are all of these things going to look like? And things just kept slowly shifting because just the populace and everybody else, it took off and there was no controlling it. And not to get overly political, but that didn't obviously have to happen. We could have done a lot better and we didn't. But what it did is it cratered the industry. And not just conventions, but I mean live events in general. The thing with conventions, though, is that it's always been, no matter how big or small they are, these are intimate affairs. These are places where the fans can go. This is church, and fan conventions just can't be that under the current circumstances. I know some are starting to try to come back. I've been seeing a lot of very small cons advertise. I've seen larger cons. I mean, WonderCon just postponed or canceled or is converting to fully virtual this year. So you're already seeing some of the bigger cons kind of readjust already for 2021. Just before I left ReadPop, we had announced our 2021 dates, which had pushed most everything into Q3, Q4. So it's going to be hard to say, you know, when these things come back, but it's hard even at a reduced capacity, even with social distancing, even with mask regulations, things like that. It's going to be hard to figure out the right way to make a large event still feel intimate without it feeling completely impersonal. Yeah. In the middle of a pandemic.
Dire prediction, masks are not going to be a problem at a Comic-Con.
No.
you mentioned a couple things there I want to touch upon. I believe the term you used is cratered the industry. Can you expand upon that? What do you mean by cratering the industry? What exactly is the business fallout here?
Well, I mean, we are a live events industry that was unable to hold live events. You look at the large promoters, right? You look at Reed Exhibitions, ReadPop, you look at Informa, you look at Left Field Media. A lot of them have suffered furloughs and layoffs over the last year. A lot of them have to let people go. There's no income coming in. The virtual events that people have been doing are good for fan engagement, but they don't generate the kind of profit needed to keep all the trains running. And that's completely understood.
That's an interesting point. Because virtual events was a curiosity of mine. It seems like a natural adaptation.
I think part of the problem is that you could get the same thing from the virtual. I could still get an autograph. I could still do a meet and greet, but the meet and greet is a Zoom meeting and the autograph is mailed to me, right? And that experience, though, is not the same as me going to a con, walking up to the table, being face to face with the coolest voice actor in the world or being able to chat with them for a few seconds and watch them sign that photo. There's an experience part of that that was missing. I don't think the virtuals are forever, but I do think the virtual is going to become a component of events moving forward.
Interesting.
I don't think anything's going to be at full capacity until at least, and this is just one guy talking,
right,
at least 2023, 2024. You're not going to see the Javits Center in New York full of 300,000 people again for a few years. You're just not.
Why do you say that? The most optimistic fan out there is going to say, well, maybe I don't get a shot in 2021, but I'll at least get it in 2022. And
of course, that's all going to come down to immunization and vaccination
right.
levels. The goal that the current administration is shooting for is, you know, late summer, early fall to be at that 70-80% vaccinated for whatever reason. And I don't know why, but I still think you're going to see, I still think there's going to be people that are going to be cautious about going out. The other thing is from my field, the celebrity stuff. Our last New York Comic Con, we had Paul Rudd, we had Tom Hiddleston, we had Mark Ruffalo in Chicago in last March. I'm not entirely certain that you see that level of celebrity back at the con, and not for lack of trying, not for lack of wanting to be there. But the pandemic has affected the entertainment industry just as badly as it has, you know, live conventions. Everybody's backed up. Everybody's working right now. You know, they're filming Thor in Australia because Australia is open. They can't film in Atlanta. So you're not going to see an Ace Comic-Con with 12 Avengers for quite some time because they're all going to be working. And they're going to be working in places where they're not going to be allowed to leave. They will be under a strict quarantine. They'll be under, I mean, you still see it now. It's actors I follow on Instagram or actors, you know, I'm just in touch with personally, like going up to Vancouver to shoot their shows. They still have to quarantine for 2 weeks.
Vancouver's a really good example because BC classified all their film industry as essential workers. But that puts them under a very specific set of rules and pods that they're kind of kept to. But they're still working.
They're right, but they're getting tested, you know, 2-3 times a day. They're, you know, a day or a week, you know, once a week. I mean, they still have to quarantine when they travel up there, and it's not like they're going to be allowed to leave Vancouver to fly back to, you know, Kansas City to do a con over the weekend and then fly back for work on Monday. And, you, and you'll see the populations, you'll see the attendee levels, you know, drop just a little bit. I think a sold out convention is going to be, you know, that's going to slide back just a little bit. But I think for the first year, that when everything's back, you're going to see reduced capacities also. You're going to see the venues requiring a certain square footage per person. That's going to shrink the attendees automatically. You know, could cut potential, you know, in half. But I think it's going to be a bit.
Before we get too far away from it, we talk about virtual events as one adaptation. I'm kind of curious, were there any? It seems like the primary one. And you're right about Wizard. I mean, I see them. I get their emails constantly. I mean, were there any other adaptations you feel that Comic-Cons had make, or I mean, even could make at this point?
I think the best example, honestly, I think the best example of what's going on right now is probably GalaxyCon. They went virtual right out the gate. And Mike and Sandy Broder had virtual events up and running, and they've been doing really, really well. They've had 2 or 3 a week for almost, you know, the last 9 months, you know, or more. They've been advertising a private signing with Sarah Michelle Gellar, which is one of the industry unicorns, so good for them. I mean, I've tried more than a few times to get her to a con, and you know, just with no luck. And I've talked to people about doing private autographing, and I think private autographing is another good way to go. I think that's a smart play. I think you see outlets like Cameo and Fanmeo and Streamily. Streamily is doing wonders right now. They hold a live stream autograph session. They get on Instagram Live and they're sitting there and they're talking to the fans and like, hey man, I've got this. Okay, so this next one, this is for Dyer out in Seattle. Okay, oh hey, you wanted the Spike print. Cool. All right, man. And they just go on and they talk about these things and they show the autograph and kind of letting the talent take matters into their own hands. And I think that's really good. And that could be another downside to getting the talent back into cons too, is that you know, they're doing just fine working from home. Is there a need to travel?
Somehow you knew it was going to be the Spike print. Let me ask you this. We kind of danced around this issue, though, but I have an assumption. I'm assuming these conventions are not staffed like they once were. You talked about lack of revenue and layoffs. You know, what exactly are we looking at from the other side of the curtain?
There will likely be some rehires, but I think ultimately it's a game of... I was going to say dominoes, but I think it's more like Jenga at this point. Okay. It's I don't see any of these companies hiring back until they know for sure they're going to have a convention. When they do know that, then I think they will hire back gradually. They hold the first couple conventions, get a little money coming in. They can reinvest that, you know, into personnel and things like that. I think you'll see that with Left Field. I think you'll see that with Informa. I think you'll see that with a lot of the independently owned conventions. I think you'll see a lot of the smaller cons maybe fall off even. You know, if they, you know, they already lost 2020. If they can't do 2021 also, you won't see those guys come back at all for a while.
Hmm.
Speaking you know, across the board, I think Reed, you know, for Reed Pop, of the people that I know that are still with Reed Pop, it's a third of what it used to be.
Oh, wow.
You know? And they're all working, and they're all working hard. And they, and, yeah, and don't get me wrong. Listen, I love everybody that's still a repop from the top down, and they are working really hard right now to make sure that what's left stays there, that what's left survives, so that it all can come back. You know, things have to rebuild. This is not an extinction level event. This is not the asteroids taking out the dinosaurs. It's not an ice age. It's going to take time. It's going to take patience. The really passionate people, the really smart people, are gonna make it happen.
Before we get into what Todd just said, Rainey, I guess I'm not quite sure. What exact Comic-Cons, pop culture conventions are you more fond of? Are you more likely to attend?
I mean, my very first convention ever was SoccerCon in Washington, at the Washington State Convention Center way back in 2009. So, I mean, I've been attending conventions for almost 12 years now, about, relatively. So, you know, I really like SoccerCon. I've gone to KomoriCon. I have attended Emerald City Comic Con almost every year since 2012, 2013. And then I've also been to Boston Comic Con once when I was in Boston during the event. I only went for a Saturday. And then I've also been to, I think I already said KomoriCon, but I've been to a lot of smaller conventions around like Washington State, because there's like a lot of like really tiny events that are like 1 to 2 days long. So I try and attend a lot of them, mostly because I like seeing my friends. I like showing off the cosplay work that I do. Yeah. But yeah, I think my favorite one is probably SoccerCon, because like I feel like the first convention you ever go to kind of just always has a place in your heart. Right. But Emerald City Comic Con was the first convention I ever took my brothers to. So when we first went, they were like 12 and 13, and they were so excited to be able to go to a convention. I've been to PAX. I've also been to PAX once.
Right.
But it's really hard to get tickets to that, so I've only been once.
I agree with you. This region, it's one of the reasons why I've made this argument consistently that the Northwest is like the nerdiest corner. And a lot of that has to do with these smaller conventions that we have. So we had like RenCon, which is now KingCon. They're, I think, going to be up and running over this next coming year. They've already started advertising that they're going to the Hyatt in Renton. Ooh. I don't know much about it, but Renton City Retro, all they've said is that they're going to have like an announcement. So, and that's just Renton, right? We know we're going to have Emerald City Comic Con for December. And I do believe Rose City Comic Con, which I don't want to make people mad at me, but it's kind of my favorite one.
I don't think that's bad at all.
I want to touch upon a point that Todd had. I wasn't thinking necessarily about this, and maybe it's more obvious than I gave it credit for. The attendance at these conventions are probably going to be a lot less. He expects that these conventions are going to have caps on their attendance placed by the facilities. And then he was pretty sure that maybe folks aren't going to be as confident going to these events as they once were. He's looking at it from someone that actually organizes them. I'm looking at it as an attendee, and I feel like people have been kind of trapped inside for so long. I almost feel like the moment that any level of measurable vaccines that's significant, I almost feel like people are just going to rush out and go to these things.
I have friends that they're like, the moment that a convention is safe and you know, I feel confident going, I will be there the whole time, and I am excited to go. I know that there's a group of people that wanted to do cosplay stuff with me, and they are hoping that sometime in August that'll happen. I was like, I don't think we should get so excited about August, because, you know, I feel like I wouldn't feel confident going to a photo shoot with like 12 other people if like most of us either didn't have the vaccine or it wasn't safe.
Right.
I'm excited for when conventions come back, because as a cosplayer, and just the fact that most of my friends attend those, that's kind of the only time I get to see them, because we may be cosplayers, but usually that's not our full-time job. I don't like the idea that there's like a cap on things. Like PAX is really hard to get tickets for, because they technically have a cap. And then once the tickets are gone, they're kind of gone, or, you know, you have to buy it from a scalper or something.
I want to go back to something that you just said, because you said the conversation with you and your friends has really been, I believe the phrase that you said was, when it's safe. And I'm finding that everybody's definition of safe is a little bit different. And for me, I think the definition of safe, as far as going to a convention is trying to get to the herd immunity, a.k.a. everybody's vaccinated enough. That's a logical line. But I think there's a lot of other folks who just feel kind of like, well, once we just see case numbers go down, then we're good.
I personally won't feel confident enough to go until I have had the vaccine. And I am not, you know, I am not a frontline worker. I am not a, not taking care of anyone who's older. I no longer live with my grandma who's older. So like, I haven't even looked into it, because I'm like, there are people that need it more than I am. I need it. And I can stay in my house if that means keeping people safe. Until I have the vaccine myself, and I know that at least the people that I will be around have the vaccine, I may go to a convention after that fact, but I will probably still wear a mask.
Oh, yeah. No.
So
the message that's going out there now is like even if you have the vaccine, let's still wear a mask. Let's still practice the safe things, because it's kind of like, you know, if we were punching this virus in the face, like punch it with every shot you got, you know, punch it with a vaccine, punch it with a mask. I don't know why my metaphor got so violent all of a sudden. Maybe I have some issues with this pandemic, but you know, like just hit it with everything you got.
Well, to me, as somebody who's visited Japan, at least in Japan's culture, if you are sick, you wear a mask. You know, you do, because you want to protect yourself and other people. I feel like in America, if you're sick, you just go out and you're like, you're going to cough onto people just because you feel like, you know, it's fine. It's probably just a cold, but you don't know how sick you are.
Right.
I would like it if America as a whole takes, I know that most Americans would be like, I never want to wear a mask again. Like, even if you don't like wearing it, if you are sick, you should be wearing one, because while it might not be 100% accurate for getting, you know, every bit of whatever you sneeze or cough out, you know, inside the mask, it helps protect other people against that.
Well, this kind of goes back to the character of America. We talk about kind of the cultural differences. This is getting out of the geek niche, but I'll say it anyway. America has always had a tug of war with almost two identities. Neither one of them is wrong or right. You know, it's the individual versus the community. And we play tug of war with that, I think, all throughout history. And it's gone good and bad for us. And I think when we have this pandemic, we're playing tug of war with it again. People are more arguing about, like, why should I wear a mask, me? Well, now is not the time for that. That's not beneficial for the progression of our culture here, of our society, of our nation, you know? Now is not the time. Now is the time for wearing masks and all of us coming together to work together. And maybe in the future, then we can get back to that debate, the lines between individual and community. I mean, that's just kind of like this classic thing. And I think that's what we're running into now, is people don't understand that now is the wrong time for that tool in our in our country. But sorry, weird rabbit hole to go off to. But
No, I agree.
I am also in the same situation as you, in that I'm probably not going to get a vaccine until the summer or so, I'm hoping. Given the most optimistic assessments, we'll see. Before I get too far away from the other point, though, is that Todd also brought up this thing that I wasn't even considering, and it was the whole focus on the talent. And of course, this is totally his realm, celebrity talent. Celebrities after the pandemic kind of don't need to go back to conventions. They have all these other avenues that are now open to them that maybe they'll be more preferable, let alone the fact that over the next 2 years, all of these actors, writers, all this talent is probably going to be bound up someplace else, catching up on all the work they lost over this last year.
I guess it really depends on each person, because I bet that there are going to be some celebrities that like it better not having to meet their fans, because I mean, I know some cosplayers that have a lot of fans that don't really like meeting their fans necessarily, you know, so not to say that they don't like their fans, but like having to go and be like bombarded with a lot of people. There will be people who want to still go and meet their fans because they like it.
Right. There's an intimacy there, right?
Yeah. Like I love going to conventions, and actually at Rose City Comic Con one time, that was the first time anyone had ever heard my voice and then asked me, are you the cosplayer Rainy Renton? I was like, what? You know who I am? So, I mean, I loved that, you know, that interaction was able to happen, and that only happened because I was able to go to a convention.
Well, with that, I would actually like to hear a lot more from the listeners. I'd like to hear what other folks are thinking about when it comes to these conventions coming up. If you're listening to this podcast, I would very much like to hear what other folks are thinking. What exactly is your line of safety? Let us know. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we're all out there. Send us your voice. Now, having said all of that, I think it is now time for us to get into the news. So by now, you've probably heard a lot about the Perseverance rover landing on Mars. There's a lot of really great video of it out there that NASA has put out. But I'm curious how many folks out there know about Ingenuity, and that is the device on Perseverance that's going to test if flight is possible on Mars. Ingenuity is this little helicopter. It's attached to Perseverance, and it's going to see if it can actually get a little of the flight going on that planet. It uses these carbon fiber tube legs. And those little carbon fiber tube legs, those are the product of Goodwin Composites out of Mount Vernon, Washington. Little bit of congratulations to Goodwin's Composites. I think that's a pretty good PR move if your product can withstand the negative 130 degrees on another planet. Beyond that, Dr. Tim Alum, he's with the University of Washington's Applied Physics Department. And his office is pretty crazy busy right now that Perseverance has landed. His specialty is X-ray spectroscopy. Any chance that you know what that is?
No.
It's okay if you don't, because I didn't either.
I don't know much about it, no.
Anyway, basically, X-ray spectroscopy is looking at elements on the periodic table with X-rays, because they all emit X-rays of sorts, and if you're able to analyze that, those X-rays are reflective of an element's energy. You can analyze all that information and see exactly what you are looking at when you can't be there physically.
That's cool.
There's a planetary instrument on Perseverance. It's called PIXL. That stands for Planetary Instrument for X-ray Lithochemistry. It's very unique, and it was designed by Dr. Tim Alum over at UW. So why does all that matter? Why the big lead up? Well, I sat down with Dr. Alum and had him explain exactly why his office is so busy right now. Beyond just looking at the data and so forth, what do you hope to find out about this planet way over there?
Well, there are several main goals of this mission. One of the really big ones, and the one, of course, that we all dream about, is just figuring out whether there's some evidence that at sometime in the past, there was actually life on Mars. That obviously is a big question for everybody in the world. But what we're looking for is not life that's living now, but evidence of past life, which are basically fossils. I think everyone is familiar with, or most people are familiar with, petrified trees.
Yeah.
Where a tree has been, you know, the organic part of the tree has been replaced by minerals over time. But if you slice through it, it still looks like a tree. You can see the patterns of the rings and stuff like that. And rocks don't form in that pattern on their own. They have completely different patterns. So those are the kind of things that we're looking for, is a spatial relationship and a spatial and chemical structure that is evidence that in the past, something organic and something alive produced that structure or produced the framework on which that structure formed.
So that's actually interesting. That was one of the things I was curious about. Your work is actually part of the mission to determine, was there life on Mars?
Yes, that's exactly right. And this instrument was designed, the principal investigator, Abby Aldwood, has done that for very ancient rocks on Earth, and was one of the people who showed that, you know, we can trace the origin of life on Earth way back to a certain time in certain rocks. And she conceived and designed this instrument specifically for that purpose. Of course, along with all the other instruments that are on the rover, were designed pretty much with that in mind.
Are you sleeping okay now? I mean, at this point, this is a lot of excitement, I got to say. Well, I mean, like, you're just about ready to peer at some rocks and solve a pretty big question. So I imagine, I don't know if there's a lot of coffee going on in your world, but it's a lot of excitement.
It's a lot of excitement. And I'm happy to say that in the last couple of nights, I got a pretty good night's sleep. But there were several days in there when it was dicey. And of course, when we have data from our instrument, which we've done once so far, some checkout data, we're all sitting on the edge of our seats waiting for that data to arrive on Earth and looking at it as soon as it comes in, no matter what hour of the day or night it might be. You know, these are the kind of things we live for. So it's very, very exciting.
Perseverance has a lot going on with just this one rover. There's a lot of projects on it, experiments for flight and so forth. I mean, is there anything that has you kind of excited or has piqued your curiosity that maybe folks aren't talking about as much?
I guess I would say two things, which in some ways are a little bit more mundane than the things we've talked about so far. One of them is the fact that in these rocks, as we analyze the relationship of these rocks, the history of a rock is written in the minerals that are present in that rock and their arrangement. You know, certain things form at certain temperatures and pressures and things, and that tells a lot about it. So every time we analyze a rock, we're learning more about the history of Mars and what it's like as a planet and gaining an understanding of it. We're nowhere near the understanding we have of Earth, of course, but that's the goal, is to get there. And that's something we kind of lose track of because it's not exciting video or anything like that. The other thing is that this rover carries an experiment that's actually aimed at figuring out how we're going to send people to Mars and bring them home safely. Hmm. And that's the MOXIE instrument. We're learning how to produce oxygen, not so much for the people to breathe, as for the oxidant in the fuel, because that's a huge burden to have to carry up there and then enough to be able to use a rocket to send us back. And if we can produce the oxygen there, it's a tremendous weight savings, which of course makes the whole mission a lot easier. So that's something that's kind of doesn't always get a lot of attention, but in my opinion, and again, let me remind everyone that my opinions are my own and not necessarily those of the organizations I work with. But in my opinion, that's really a difference in this mission and a significant step forward that is really going to make a huge difference in the long term.
So one thing that Dr. Ilum actually told me as well that I thought was pretty cool, that Perseverance is not only using Pixel, that X-ray device that he helped design, it's not only using that to collect information and send the data back to Earth, it's also taking those samples that it's X-raying and it's sealing them up and saving them for later. So the idea is that they're already looking ahead, that they're going to save these samples for somebody to actually put their hands on.
I have friends who want to go to Mars. They were like, oh, the second that it's available, I'm signing up. And I was like, no, I'm okay.
Oh, I'm still working on Nina. I'm telling her, like, they're going to need journalists on Mars. Not going so well so far, but I'm working on it. I mean, does anything kind of stand out to you now after hearing him talk about it that, gosh, this could be like the thing that tells us that there was life on Mars?
I think aliens 100% exist. I am that meme where he just goes aliens.
So you don't...
I agree.
All right. So you already know.
There are things out there and maybe they'll find us eventually or we'll find them. I hope they don't think humans are embarrassing, but I think any information that proves that there is life on other planets brings joy to my heart, honestly. Yeah.
I just hope they don't think humans are delicious. It seems like you approach this more like I do, in that aliens probably exist if you just statistically speak about it. Like, just with everything out there, probably a safe bet to say something is evolving out there somewhere else. Whether or not...
I mean, we exist, so... Well, exactly. I mean, if we exist, humans are not the center of the universe. So, like, I mean, if we somehow happen to exist, obviously somewhere out there,
right,
there is something else that also exists.
Whether they've found us or not, or we found, I mean, that's kind of like the question that we go to next. But I think if you find evidence on Mars, however, that only adds to this evidence that you have for that argument that, look, there was another planet. Ancient life once existed there. And here's the fossils of it. Here's the proof. I think that really does lean into this argument that, yeah, if we go to these other planets, at least if we know they're in what they call the Goldilocks zone, it's a region of space around a star where they feel that there is an environment that encourages life. You know, I think that's going to be pretty, pretty mind-blowing for a lot of people on Earth. I wonder, one, how many people are actually going to believe it. Two, how that's actually going to change people's perspectives if we're able to prove that things don't just so uniquely happen just on this one planet. I think we should go into our next little news item that I found a little interesting. If you have a few minutes, take the time, go over to Netflix's company webpage. Just look for a video they have there called Inclusion Takes Root. It has a main interview with a woman named Verna Meyer. She's a vice president of inclusion strategy at Netflix. Here's basically what Netflix has done recently, or at least they did it over the past 2 years, and they're just releasing the results now. They commissioned a study that looked at the inclusion in its content and in its company. Is the content actually reflecting what actually is going on in the USA? You know, the groups that are represented, the characters that you're seeing, are they actually a representative of the people you're actually going to walk out your door and be with in the United States? And it's a similar thing for the company, you know, where are, who is actually in which leadership roles and the employees and so forth. And what's unique about this is they actually released the data, which I don't think a lot of companies would do. And yeah, they're basically kind of touring around this information to let the audience know what Netflix is going to be up to moving forward.
That as they do their job, they're thinking about who's not here. Are we gathering all the perspectives? We are all deserving of opportunity.
I think if we are to ever realize our ambitions around the world, we have to tell stories that reflect the population. In order for us to tell those stories, we have to have inclusion on screen.
Those were the voices of Verna Myers and Ted Sarandos. Rainey, you were able to take a look at that video, Inclusion Takes Root. Is there any immediate takeaways that you got from that?
Well, as someone who is mixed, you know, I actually appreciate the fact that they are trying to be more inclusive to different types of people, different people of color, LGBT plus and so forth. So I'm happy to know that they are telling those types of stories, because I feel like sometimes people don't. Because for some people, it might make them uncomfortable, because anything that's different than yourself tends to make people very uncomfortable. And I don't think it needs to be uncomfortable. I think it's good to share those stories so it eventually becomes normal. Kind of like people who are not LGBT plus also sharing their pronouns, even if you use she, her, or he, him, or whatever, because then it makes it normalized, I guess. So as someone who is a woman and is LGBTQ plus, because I'm not, I mean, I may, you know, have a husband, but I'm bisexual, so that's what I am. And also I'm mixed. I have a very different perspective than somebody who might be a male or even a female who may be just white or just black and not be LGBT plus. Because whatever things that you have in your life, if there's something outside of that little realm or little circle, it then becomes uncomfortable. And if you don't have any of that knowledge that's in there, you might have that knee-jerk reaction of like, oh, maybe I don't like this thing anymore. So I like that Netflix is trying to tell these stories of different people, so that even if you don't have, maybe you don't have any Asian friends or any black friends or any, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, you can have a little circle of friends that are all the same race, and that just might be how things are. But if you are able to understand other people's stories, you might be more sympathetic towards other people and other cultures that you might not fully understand. So I do like that they are telling these stories that have not had a lot of spotlight recently and are working towards making not a program necessarily, but like a service that doesn't just cover one majority type of person or majority type of story. It really wants to tell the stories of America as a whole. And America is not one thing.
Right.
Like, some people may argue America is supposed to be this. It's like America
it's
was built.
It's never been one thing. I mean, that's I think the great illusion that a lot of people throw out there is that look at how many people always reference founding father ABC. Like, everybody references them for totally different arguments, usually conflicting arguments. And that's, I think, the great illusion that sometimes people have about the country is that it is one thing. Mm-hmm. It's never been. They didn't agree on anything at the start. They still don't, you know? But that's kind of like the point. We're supposed to find a way through together. You know, a couple other thoughts that you brought up there. I think this is a cliche I'm about to throw out there. I apologize, but there is that old cliche that you fear what you don't know. And yep. You know, it's a simplistic view of things, but I think it's true. But if you know it, you don't fear it so much. And not everybody has access to, you know their neighbor, you know, because maybe their neighbor is across the city. You know, maybe their neighbor's across the state. Not everybody has access to that, but I think we all have access to Netflix to some degree. As weird
or at
as
least
that
to the
sounds.
Yeah. You know, some stuff that ends up on Netflix, eventually clips of it end up on YouTube and other places.
Right.
So
I think that's the thing, is I think that, like I said, at the very least, it seems their basement level goal is to have Netflix represent exactly what is going to be out your door when you walk out it. And if you can at least at that basement level, I think it's going to be a lot easier to know your neighbor. But anyway, I don't know if you know this story or not, but back in the day, MTV in the 80s when they were starting out, there's a really good interview with David Bowie and an MTV VJ. And he was asking, like...
But there seem to be a lot of black artists making very good videos that I'm surprised aren't used on MTV.
And the guy was like, well, the thing is...
Well, of course, also, we have to try and do what we think not only New York and Los Angeles will appreciate, but also Poughkeepsie or Midwest, pick some town in the Midwest that will be scared to death by Prince, which we're playing, or a string of other black faces.
That's
and black
very
music.
Interesting. Isn't that interesting?
David Bowie had like this look on his face where he's like,
it not possible that it should be a conviction of the station and of other radio stations, to be fair? It does seem to be rampant through American media. Should it not be a challenge to try and make the media far more integrated?
It's not like it was in 67 where you say, yeah, I'm not into that, you know, but you are. Yeah. Now it's, you're into that, I don't like you. And that's scary, and we can't just turn around and go, well, look, this is the right way. We can only teach, I think, a little bit at a time.
Interesting. Okay, thank you very much.
Does that make sense? Valid point?
I understand your point of view.
Okay. But eventually, I think everybody figured out that it's not that big of a deal for Michael Jackson to moonwalk across the screen. Like, that was really not a threat, you know? And
well, I also think, though, that, like, America as a whole, like, America is a country, right? So, like, yeah, maybe people in Washington will have different views than people in the Midwest, but maybe think about why those views are different. You know, like, as a provider of entertainment, ask, why are we catering specifically to one area over another area? And I know you can't make everyone happy. There's no way to make every single person happy. But if you're going to cater then to only the Midwest, are you just not catering to the people who are just okay? I don't know. It just seems very odd to cater to one area and be like, well they wouldn't like it.
It's a flipped philosophy, right?
Yeah.
We're going to limit what we put on as content because of this issue. Netflix is doing the opposite of, we're not going to limit what we're going to have as content because of this issue. I mean, it's Netflix.
Like,
it's not like you're going to have a limited variety of things to watch on that streaming service. And this is just one of them.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like there's going to be a limited variety. It's Netflix. But anyway, yeah.
I agree.
And with that, I think that's going to close out our news discussion for this episode of Northwest Nerd Rainy. Before I go into my usual outro shtick thing that I do, you want to tell everybody where they can find you across the interwebs?
Almost anywhere. Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Twitch, all under the exact same name. You can Google me and it'll come up with basically all of them.
But if they went to the public school I did, just in case, Rainy Renton is spelled how?
RainyRenton.
Y-N.
Not like the city.
That's right. Okay, and with that, I am going to give special thanks out to Todd Jones, Dr. Tim Ilum, and cosplayer Rainy Renton, who you can find across the interwebs as we just covered. Music in this episode was by the Hoot Hoots, who do our theme music. Follow Northwest Nerd on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're across the interwebs too, probably not as far as Rainy Renton, she's on Twitch. You can also find more info at nw-nerd.com. And with that, we're going to be back in another couple weeks with another episode of Northwest Nerd. Until then, this is Dire Oxley with Northwest Nerd.